This series is brought to you with the kind support of Wellington Management, one of the world's largest independent asset managers. Wellington believes in the importance of a diverse workforce, equitable opportunities for all colleagues to reach their potential, and an inclusive culture.
Nobody wins the gender game, right? Because what happened was I was too masculine as a woman, and then I was perceived as gay because all of a sudden I became too feminine as a man in some people's eyes. And so there's really no winning that gender game. And once I realized that, I just stopped playing it. And I just settled into me, who I am, right? The kind of man that I am, not looking for any particular way to be a man.
Ethan Devitt, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus series, in which we are celebrating LGBTQ+ professionals in a special series for Pride Month 2022. I'm joined today by Xander Keg, who's a social worker, emotional wellness and personal growth webinar facilitator, a mental fitness coach, and social care clinical consultant based in Central Florida. He's an advocate for mental health, trans veterans, and trans social care, and was named NASW National Social Worker of the Year in 2020, and NASW California Social Worker of the Year in 2018. Welcome, Xander. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Effin. It's an honor to be here.
Delighted to have you. Let's start by talking about your background. Can you tell us where you grew up and what your early interests were?
Sure. I grew up in Southern California, bouncing back and forth between my dad's house in Los Angeles, my mom's house in San Diego. I'm a first-generation American with Mexican heritage. I refer to myself as Latino, L-I-T-N-O. For those who are unfamiliar with the language, I was raised in a Roman Catholic family, and so adhered pretty strictly to those traditions, going through confirmation, first communion, things like that as a young person. In my early childhood, I experienced some adversarial issues. My parents divorced when I was two. I developed a brain illness following a measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination when I was six. And that resulted in me actually contracting the rubella, which is the German measles. I spent a few months in the hospital and then approximately 2 years in rehabilitation, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy. So my first earliest childhood memory is from around 8 years of age. And I don't really recall much about what my interests were when I was that young. I'd say my earliest memory of interest areas is when I'm about 12 years old. And at that point in my life, I was really engaged in athletics. So I was playing soccer, tennis, I was swimming. I was the goalie on the American Youth Soccer Organization's team in my hometown. I was taking tennis lessons and also swimming lessons. So I grew up near the beach in Southern California. So I spent a lot of time at the beach. So that's basically my early years.
Well, certainly that aspect, growing up near the beach, sounds idyllic. And I know AYSO well through my own children's activities here in the Chicago area. I wonder, did that lead to your vocation as a caregiver?
Well, it's interesting how certain memories stick out. And so even though I have hardly any memories at all of the entire time that I was hospitalized because of this brain illness, it was called encephalitis. It means inflammation of the brain tissue. And I was in a coma for a couple of weeks. And it's like there is one memory from that whole experience that sticks out. I can never forget it. It's just sort of in there. And that's one day I needed to go to the bathroom and I buzzed the nurse and somebody came into the room and I said, I need to go to the bathroom. And she said something like, well, then get yourself to the bathroom. I think maybe she didn't realize that I was paralyzed on the whole left side of my body and I was lying in a bed. And so I was sort of like, well, okay, I'm going to get myself to the bathroom. So I basically flung myself out of the bed and was dragging myself across the floor when somebody said, what are you doing? You know, and put me back in bed. And I said, well, the nurse told me to go to the bathroom on my own. And so I'm not sure what happened to that nurse, but there's something about that experience that stuck with me as far as one, the busyness of hospitals and how sometimes people can be a bit derelict in their duties, having worked in the hospital. As a social worker, I can recognize that, you know, things do get busy and the needs of the patients can be quite demanding. And it's easy if we're not paying attention to keeping ourselves in check, that we could really mistreat people because they're very vulnerable and they're reliant upon us, dependent on us to provide a lot of the care for them, a lot of the services that normally people take for granted, like going to the bathroom.
No, it's interesting. I was in a hospital bed myself after a febrile convulsion, age 2. And that is my earliest memory, is that hospital bed and the fan that they put on me. There's something very visceral about hospital experiences. Now, let's move now to talk about your career. So sporty youth. And then what was your career journey to this point?
I'd say my first real job was when I joined the U.S. Coast Guard. I was 20 years old at that point. Prior to that, I had held a bunch of random jobs. I worked as a cashier at a gas station. I was a silkscreen printing operator, meaning I was dragging the piece of rubber across with the inks to make the t-shirts or whatever, you know, I was making. And I also was restocking vending machines. So I had a lot of different odds and ends jobs. But when I went into the military, that's really where I'd say that's my first career. I was a firefighter, an EMT, which is an emergency medical technician, and also a boarding officer. So basically a first responder on the water. A lot of people might not know this, but one of the nicknames for people in the Coast Guard are Smokies of the Sea. And that's referring to, here in the United States, Smokey the Bear. It's an image used to promote the prevention of wildfires. So doing firefighting and law enforcement on the water, we were called Smokies of the Sea. After the military, I went into law enforcement. So a couple of different jobs. I became an undercover narcotics agent for a private firm that was run by retired DEA agents. So the Drug Enforcement Agency, Department of Justice. My assignment posts were in both private and municipal settings. So for example, I was working for a utilities company in a major metropolitan city in California, where I was sent in to investigate employees who were either misusing time off because of issues having to do with drug addiction or drug abuse, or they were actually doing drugs at work, and they were at work while they were intoxicated, which was negatively impacting productivity, but also could be very dangerous. What if they are operating heavy equipment, vehicles, working with children, whatever they were doing? I also worked as a liaison officer for a school district up in the Northern California area, where I was a plainclothes officer on a high school campus working with the school district's law enforcement department as a liaison between the school district, and then the local police and sheriff's office. So I was in charge of making sure we had a closed campus, that people couldn't leave campus or come onto campus late trying to sneak in, non-students trying to get onto campus, people trying to sneak off at lunch, escorting students to the office if they were being reported as disrupting class, things like that. So a lot of really interesting work. Ultimately, I decided to leave law enforcement. At the time, I'm a trans man, but at the time I was a lesbian. I was a very masculine woman. And being a very masculine woman in law enforcement, it shouldn't surprise anybody that a masculine woman would be in law enforcement, but we're talking about a time back in the late 80s when there wasn't as much visibility and there weren't as many rights as we have now legally for LGBT people. And so there was a lot of harassment and discrimination, none that I really experienced directly, but it was all around me. And I just didn't want to be part of that environment anymore. So I took a total 180 and I went into the natural foods industry. So I went to work in a grocery store called Wild Oats, which no longer exists. They were bought up by Whole Foods a few years back. But I was the manager of a department called Special Services. We did the demos and did the classes and made up all the gift baskets and things like that for the customers. And then I also cooked in 3 different restaurants that were mostly vegetarian or vegan oriented. And I did that for a number of years until the mid-1990s, when I decided that I was kind of done with working and I wanted to go to college. Now, I should backtrack and say that because of the brain damage that I had as a child, I missed a couple of years of school, went right into the 3rd grade. By the time I was in 6th grade, I was routed into special education and dropped out in the 8th grade. And then I was made to go to school because it's the law. And I was in sort of like a juvenile delinquent school for a couple of years. I just had a really difficult time with school. I was intelligent, but I was having trouble in school. And so ultimately, I dropped out of high school and went and got my GED so I could go into the military. But I had decided in the mid-1990s that I was going to go to college. I thought, well, how hard can it be? Right? So I applied to 1 college. I got accepted and I enrolled a few months later. I majored in interpersonal communication. I minored in philosophy, and I had a great time in college. I served on the Student Government Assembly as the VP of Communications. I founded a student organization called the Auraria Queer Alliance, Granted, this was in the mid-1990s in Denver, Colorado. So we had a really progressive campus. I worked as a work study in the GLBT Student Services Office, Gay, Lesbian, Bi, Trans. So in the 1990s, we had that office on our campus. It wasn't bisexual and transgender, it was bi and trans. So transgender became more commonly used, but now people have sort of reverted back to saying trans because it incorporates many, many different identities. Following college, I decided to go to graduate school. I was encouraged to go to graduate school by my advisor in college. My first question to her was, what's graduate school? Because both of my parents hadn't even finished high school, so I didn't know what graduate school was. And when I was done with graduate school, I decided to go to seminary and get a master's in theology. My first master's was in conflict resolution, and I wanted to go to seminary because I had encountered for so many years people saying that because of their religious beliefs and convictions, they couldn't be accepting of LGBT people and our, quote, lifestyle. And so I wanted to go to seminary to have a better understanding of, like, where are they getting those ideas? So I did a two-year degree in seminary. I went to work for a few years doing some case management work with Salvation Army and Job Corps. And then I went and got my MSW in clinical social work, and I finished that program in 2012. I did an internship in my second year of that program at the VA hospital serving veterans in San Diego County on the inpatient psych unit. So I decided then that I was going to seek out a job with the Department of Veterans Affairs. And my first job right out of my MSW program was with the VA, working with the Healthcare for Homeless Veterans program. I was there for about 4 years, and then I transferred over to the Navy. But I wanted a shift from working with the older, chronically homeless, mentally ill, medically compromised population to working with a younger, housed, employed, and healthier population, but still staying within the federal government. And so I moved over to the Navy. And I was very, very fortunate because a month after I started with the Navy, a memo came out saying that transgender service members were going to be able to serve openly and would be able to go through a command-approved gender transition. And so I was there at the foreground of that, and I was one of the people appointed to the Navy Medicine West transgender care team. And I worked with about 300 active duty service members over the course of about 3.5 years. It was a great job. I loved it. Subsequently, I've gone out on my own. I've left working in the government system as a social worker. And for the last couple of years, 2.5 years really, I've been doing the emotional wellness, personal growth, and mental fitness work on my own as an independent contractor, and really have been loving that work. It's like one of the best moves I ever made. It was quite risky. You know, I went out on my own in July of 2020, right in the middle of a pandemic lockdown. I left my secure federal government job and went out on my own. So a lot of people thought I was crazy, but I really have landed on my feet, and I'm really happy where I am now and what I'm doing.
When you went out on your own, you'd already been awarded the National Social Worker of the Year. So clearly you'd already got recognition. I just wanted to ask you about the work you've done with the vulnerable population, because that certainly is a thread that runs right through this extraordinarily diverse career background. How have you coped with that? Because it can't always be easy to deal with troubled youth or perhaps homeless veterans who probably have mental health struggles. What do you do in your own mindset to, I suppose, stay the course through challenging environments like that?
Sure. Well, I should say I have never worked with youth. So I've always worked with adults as a social worker. I made a conscious choice not to work with youth. I find that to be, it's just outside of my interest area. I wanted to work with adults. I wanted to work with veterans. The fact that most social workers who work at the VA are working with the Healthcare for Homeless Veterans program is how I ended up into that program. And as an adolescent, I had the experience of homelessness myself in my early 20s. I also had a little bit of a time in shelters, staying in shelters and being homeless. So, you know, it was easy for me to just tap into that experience of my own, that both of those times were before I was in the military. So I wasn't a homeless veteran, but I was homeless, and I encountered a lot of homeless veterans during those experiences. And I think one of the foundational principles that social workers are formed by, one of our guiding principles, is to meet people where they are, right? To not have all of these ideas in our head about what they should be doing, who they should be, where they should be, what they should be doing. It's like when I encountered a veteran, they were homeless. my first question always to them, because they came to us because I was doing homeless triage. I wasn't out in the field. My first question to them would be the same as a person coming in seeking psychotherapy. What brings you in today? And you go from there, right? You meet people where they are. You treat people with dignity. You provide people with the services they need, the resources they need, the linkages to other people and other programs and services that can provide them even additional services and resources. So I never had any trouble wrapping my mind around that. As a matter of fact, from time to time, I would be working with a veteran who, for one reason or another, was having difficulty getting services through maybe a different program or even just a different social worker in my clinic. And that might be because they were really angry. They were like aggressive veterans. And that never caused me any concern. I would bring them into my office. I'd shut the door and I'd have a civil discussion with them. And I wasn't troubled by their anger. I mean, I understood their anger. They served their country and now they're out begging for food and being arrested for finding places to use the bathroom. So I kind of understood that. We also have veterans who, for one reason or another, are on something like maybe the sex registry list. And so they're not eligible for federal programs like housing programs and other programs when they're on that list, but they would still come into the homeless triage program. And so I would help them taking a shower, doing their laundry, getting some food, and finding resources and services that they could access because they couldn't access all of our resources. So I just treated them like a person. That doesn't mean they don't have personal opinions about maybe what they did that caused them to be on that registry, but they were a veteran, they were homeless, they were seeking services, and that was my job. So I didn't judge them. I just provided the services.
Now, clearly, the focus on dignity is key there, yeah. Their dignity. So let's move now to your own story of your own transition. At what stage did you transition to being a man, and what did you learn from that you would like other people, maybe young people in transition, to know?
The way I would talk about it is that I shifted from saying I was a lesbian to saying I was trans, not transgender, but just trans, in 1998. And that's after meeting some trans people, reading a couple trans books. I was, at the time, I was still in college. I graduated in 1999. So I was working in the GLBT Student Services Office. So I was reading books. I was meeting people. I was involved in a lot of our programming and the work that we were doing. And so I was influenced by all of that exposure. And so for me, trans didn't mean that I was going to do a gender transition. I just thought of trans, and I had learned this from listening to other people talk, that a trans person, at least at the time, could be somebody who just was transgressing gender norms. So as a masculine woman, I was transgressing the societal norms that women are feminine, right? So I was using trans in that way. I was transgressive. But I didn't start cross-sex hormone therapy or gender-affirming hormone therapy until 2005. So I was 39 years old at the time. I had lived many, many years. I had been out and part of lesbian community since I was 16 years old. So I had been very active and visible. So that switch from going from lesbian community to trans community or lesbian identified to trans identified, there were some struggles with that. I'll say that during the first couple of years while I was on testosterone, I was still very androgynous appearing. So even though I was a masculine woman, I was androgynous in the sense that people were often confused if I was a boy or a girl. So people didn't read me, so to speak, as a man. So some people would sir me and some people would ma'am me, for example. Some people would see me as a lesbian. Some people would see me as a gay man. I often got confused for a gay man, because I had some feminine traits that were showing up as I looked more and more manly in my appearance. My mannerisms were now being read as feminine, whereas before they were masculine because I was a masculine appearing woman. It's a really interesting thing to see happen and to experience that. But then about 4 years after being on testosterone, testosterone is a very powerful hormone. And so my voice was getting pretty deep. My facial hair started to sprout. Fat redistribution on my body. So they were hard pressed to see anything but man. And then that changed how people were treating me. So I started to notice that that difference in treatment was happening. And as I was being treated differently, that was helping me to formulate a sense of who I was and who I was becoming. And I shifted out of being that androgynous kind of genderqueer person to more masculine, but now as a man, and referring to myself as a trans man or a man. But it took a few years before I was comfortable doing that. But ultimately, I did start to do that. In part of the work that I did in those early days, I was co-facilitating a couple of FTM support groups. That's female to male. That's old languaging, but I still use it because I'm old. I'm almost 56. So I was facilitating a couple peer support groups, one in San Francisco, and then I moved to San Diego. I was presenting at FTM and trans conferences at the time, not social work yet because I hadn't become a social worker. And over the last 17 years or so, I've been on testosterone for 17 years. I've co-edited and self-published 3 anthologies of trans men's stories. I've been featured in a few of documentaries, and one in particular, I'm the only subject of the documentary. It's called Xanderology. I've conducted several CE courses, continuing education courses for social workers and other behavioral health specialists like psychologists, licensed mental health provider, counselors, and marriage and family therapists who want to learn more about how to provide culturally and linguistically appropriate care services to their trans clients, non-binary clients, gender diverse clients. For those early in medical transition, I don't have much to say to young people. Again, I don't work with young people, and I try to stay out of the giving advice to young people. There's so much controversy around young people who are identifying as trans and wanting to do transition, and I like to stay away from that topic as much as possible. So I'll just say for those who are in their early in their medical transition, regardless of their age, one thing that I would recommend, and I do really highly recommend this, is that you wait somewhere between 3 and 4 years before you write a book, before you speak in a film, before you start offering diversity training workshops, and before you start seeking a leadership position in an organization that's either for trans people or LGBT people, or like running your employee resource group. And the reason for that is there's so much that's unknown about what's going to happen to you as an individual during this medical transition. I'm talking specifically to people who are medically transitioning. It's different if you're just doing a social transition. But there's so much that's unknown in those early days. There's so many changes we go through. We go through physical changes. We go through social changes. We go through mental changes, occupational changes. Doesn't mean we switch jobs, but how we're treated in our workplace definitely changes for a lot of us. We go through legal changes, right? We're legally changing our name. We're legally changing our sex. We're getting new identity documents like a new driver's license, a new passport, a new diploma. And we go through a lot of emotional changes. Hormones affect our emotions. And so my guidance would be that when you're in the first couple of years of your transition, that transition is what really is deserving of your full attention, right? And if you're in relationship, making sure that your partner isn't left in the dust. Gender transition can be a very selfish act. We can become very hyper-focused on our own bodies and what's happening to them and our own social sphere and the change in how people are treating us and how we're feeling about things and how we're interpreting the world around us. And I think too often we neglect our partners, our family members in that process. So I'd say be attentive to your family and the people that you care about and bring them along on the journey with you and listen to them. Our parents, our partners, our siblings, our children, they might go through a grief process. The person that they thought they knew and loved and have cared for years, right, parents, they're experiencing a certain kind of loss. And I think we should affirm that loss. And I think that we should help them through that grief and give them time on their own to grieve. And what I say to people, and when I'm actually doing mentorship, when I'm talking to people, I say to them, listen, how long did it take you to come to terms with who you are and then make decisions about the things that you were going to do to make changes in your life as far as starting hormones, changing your name, all these different things? And however long that took you, right, a year, 6 years, 10 years, give that same amount of time or even more to the people that love you and have known you your whole life, because it's going to be a drastic change for them. It's not just us that's going through that transition.
Well, some very poignant and sage advice there. And thank you for sharing that. One thing I just wanted to follow up on was you mentioned how people treated you differently, first as a gay woman, then as a gay man, and then as a trans man. And they kind of went through that arc. What did you learn about people's attitudes towards the different categories, I suppose, in their heads through watching them treat you differently?
I should say I never was a gay man. That's just how people perceived me. I've been with my wife since before transition. So I would consider myself a heterosexual trans man. Well, one thing that's clear is that gender nonconformity, whether you're male or female, can provoke a lot of negative feelings in people. I think there are fewer people now than there were in the 80s and 90s, but still there are specific ethnic cultures, racial cultures, religious cultures that are very gender-based, right? Men and women have particular roles and they're to stay in those particular roles. There's a lot of norms and expectations around that. And so it's going to cause a problem for people when they see people out in society that are very masculine as women or very effeminate as men. That's regardless of whether they're gay or lesbian or not, right? It's just the gender expression that they're having trouble with. What I say to people is that nobody wins the gender game, right? Because what happened was I was too masculine as a woman, and then I was perceived as gay because all of a sudden I became too feminine as a man in some people's eyes. And so there's really no winning that gender game. And once I realized that, I just stopped playing it. And I just settled into me, who I am, right? The kind of man that I am, not looking for any particular way to be a man. Just how am I just naturally? What kind of clothes do I want to wear? How do I want to style my hair? Well, back when I had hair, how do I want to be in the world? How do I want to treat people? How do I want people to treat me? I didn't model myself after a caricature of men because I didn't do it as a woman either. Right? I didn't model myself after a caricature of women. So I'd say the biggest difference between being for myself and how I was treated before transition and how I've been treated since transition largely settles around empathy. And what I mean by that is, as a woman, and especially as a lesbian and a Latina at that, it was just assumed that I was being oppressed, marginalized, victimized, that I had faced challenges and difficulties that were only because I fit into a category of woman, Hispanic, lesbian. When I transitioned, I became a straight white man. My Hispanic part of myself became invisible. One of the things, you know, when I changed my name, I didn't pick a Spanish name. I went in a different direction. So I invited some of that on myself, I guess. And I went from being presumed to be somebody who is on the receiving end of oppression to automatically being a person who is on the perpetrating end of oppression. And I didn't like that at all. And part of what comes with that is that if you're perceived as being a victim of an unfair society and the terrible patriarchy, as I would have said as a young lesbian, then people are empathetic towards you. You get a sense that people care about you and inquire about you. And that's what happened to me. People seemed to go out of their way in some ways to connect with me and find out more about who I am and what I'm all about and what I'm doing. As a man, I could tell you people basically don't really care. I don't get asked very often at all, unless it's by family and close friends, how are you doing? Right? It's not a question I get asked very much anymore. It was a question that I was asked quite often before in one way or another, right? Maybe not so as direct as that. I went from experiencing, I wouldn't say a tight-knit community of women because there were problems, but I had a social group that I belonged to for a number of years. And when I went off into the world of cisgender men, I wasn't exactly sure where I fit, like what kind of men's group or community of men or what kind of activities that men are doing am I going to participate in? I still haven't really found my footing in that way. And I don't think the lockdowns have helped because I've moved to a new city and I haven't met very many people. So it's basically just me and my wife and some friends that I connect with back home via Zoom or telephone call. So I still haven't found my way into, even though I'm over 17 years now on testosterone, living in the world as a man, I still don't have, outside of work, just male friends, gay or straight.
Well, that's a really interesting point you make. And I think it's really important, too, that we recognize this empathy gap around straight white men, because let's be frank, they still represent a significant portion of the population. In the industry I work in, it's finance, they would be the dominant group. And I think it's a real problem if there is this empathy gap, because as we seek to build cultures of allyship and inclusion, we can't exclude the need to bring in a group simply because they've maybe dominated a field for some time. So I think you really are in a unique position to have seen both sides of that. And I really appreciate that contribution to the debate. I'm going to fast forward now.
Can I say one thing really? One thing I'll say is in social work, it's the opposite. It's a female dominated occupation. But I can tell you that in the work that I've done as a social worker, that social workers are primarily, they're seeing men in a lot of settings. And why is that? Because there are more homeless men, more men who are attempting to take their own life, more men who are jobless, right? More men who are incarcerated, right? So men are suffering to a significant degree, but we don't pay as much attention to that. So I think there's a problem there. It's like, if we really care about suicide prevention, then we should bring to the awareness of the general public that it's mostly middle-aged white men who are taking their own lives, and many of them are veterans, and that most of the homeless people out on the streets are men, and most of the people dealing with chronic mental illness and substance abuse orders that are not seeking treatment are men. So it's a huge part of our population. So it's like we can think about men dominating in certain occupations or in politics, but they're unfortunately, they're dominating at the top, but they're also dominating at the bottom. And so there's an issue going on both sides of that.
That's a really important point. And I want to shout out to another podcast on this series with Jack Dodd, whose LinkedIn post about boys get sad tooth to raise awareness of that vulnerability that is there and mental health awareness was just so powerful on LinkedIn. And that's why I captured his story for the same series. So thank you for that, Sandra. Let's just fast forward a little bit to inclusion in your professional world. And I think you've already touched on what it's like now in the world of social work. Just to go back, because you've been in the Coast Guard and you've been in service, how has, say, LGBT plus inclusion evolved through the course of your career?
So I served in the Coast Guard prior to President Clinton signing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue law. And so that meant that prior to that, people, if they were going to say the recruiting station, they could be asked, are you gay or lesbian? Or they probably say, are you a homosexual? And you had to answer them. With the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they thought that was progress. They can't ask anymore. But if they found out, they could still kick you out, right, of the military. So I was in prior to that. So a lot of people have nicknamed that the witch hunt days. So I basically had to conceal my lesbianism for the most part during my enlistment period. However, most of my friends on base were gay and lesbian. There were a lot of us on base, even though it's a Coast Guard, it's the smallest military branch. So the bases are small. There weren't very many people there. There were a lot of gay men and lesbian women on my base. So we found each other and we connected. But during the time that I was in the Coast Guard, I went into gay bars. I even was nominated for an award for Ms. Gay Pride while I was on active duty. And I was featured in the Gay Pride Parade, like sitting in the back of one of those fancy convertibles, waving at everybody with my sash on saying Ms. Gay Pride. I'll fast forward to when I was working at the VA. There's a big gap in between, of course, but I spent so much time in school. I don't have a lot of workplace examples to give that were very short term. So I'll talk about more like when I worked at the VA, this was starting in 2012. By then, I had already started testosterone and I had started it at a VA. So as far as patient care services, I started testosterone at the VA in 2005. So it wasn't until 2011, though, that there was a national VA policy that permitted trans veterans to get access to cross-sex hormones or gender-affirming hormones. But when I worked there between 2002 and 2006, I was nominated or appointed is more the language. I was appointed to two national VA work groups. One focused on LGBT patient care and one was more on the LGBT employee resource group side. And so on the LGBT patient care side, I was helping with developing trainings and reviewing and revising policy. On the LGBT employee side, I joined up with three other members of the team and we drafted what is now VA guidance for transgender employees who are going through a gender transition on the job. So that guidance still exists and I was one of the four people that was involved in drafting that. When I moved over to the Navy, that was in 2016. So by then, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed. That had happened during the Obama administration. And so gay and lesbian service members were serving out and proud if they wanted. It wasn't a requirement. And I also then was, when I was working with the transgender care team, all of a sudden now transgender service members were serving openly. I was with the transgender care team from 2016 to 2019. And what some people might be wondering is, well, wait a minute, that was during the Trump administration, right? So President Trump had sent out those tweets in August of 2017 saying that the trans people weren't going to be able to be in the military anymore. But tweets aren't policy, right? It wasn't until March of 2019 that there actually was a policy that was talking about transgender people and being on active duty in the military. And all the people who were already serving, who had already come forward, had a gender dysphoria diagnosis, had a treatment plan, everybody just got to keep going forward. None of those people were stopped from their gender transition, at least not on the Navy side. I'm not sure what the Army did, and I doubt the Air Force did that as well. And so people were still moving forward, still getting hormones, still getting surgeries, still getting to change their name in the records. None of that, right? So I worked with about 300 service members who were navigating a command-approved gender transition. And so that was on hold, right? There was a little bit of a hiatus for anybody who wanted to join the military who was trans. There were a couple of people waved in between 2019 and 2021 when the law changed again under President Biden. But for the most part, all the transgender care teams and all the branches of the military, most of them just kept moving even through the entire Trump administration. It didn't have any impact on us for the most part. So I've had both what would be considered a negative and a positive experience. But because I was surrounded by all these gay and lesbian coasties on my base, I never really worried about it because it didn't make any difference to me whether I could talk about it publicly or not. I was a lesbian and I had a girlfriend and I had gay and lesbian friends and I was active in the community. So I might have been closeted, but I wasn't not living my life.
It's interesting. It illustrates the disconnect between sometimes the headline and the reality on the ground, which I think is really important. I want to just ask you about one aspect before we move to some personal reflections, just around the initiatives that you feel work best to promote inclusion. I think you prefer integrating LGBTQ focus across every project and focusing on the individual and maybe not being as keen on affinity groups. Can you maybe just expand on that a bit?
Yeah, I like the idea of integrating LGBT stuff into whatever project or service that's being developed 365 days a year, right? Not just in June on Pride Month or not just one day of the year, right? Bringing it into the fold all the time, but not as a primary focus, but just a piece of the whole, right? Because LGBT people and our families are integrated into the fabric of our society, right? We're consumers of the goods, the entertainment, and the services that are being developed. So just integrate us in. I don't think such a big deal needs to be made about it. If companies still want to do something special around Pride Month, well, then go right ahead, because you do special things around all kinds of different special months of celebrations. But I think that if companies are only doing things 1 month out of the year, then that's not enough, right? It's too little. It should be just integrated in. And then maybe with that full integration, then more and more people will just see LGBT people as integrated into the fabric of society. Because we're in it. We're already living here in this society. So why not just include us, but not make such a big deal? The idea of the big spotlight is not my favorite, because then that upsets a whole lot of other kind of people. And I don't need everybody to accept me, like me, welcome me. I don't need the external validation of who I am and what my worth and value is. I have that for myself. And so I think too often people in our community are seeking all of that external validation and affirmation because they are having their own issues around self-acceptance, self-worth. And so I want people to get into the wellness world and get some of these skills to bolster their sense of self and their self-worth and not be so reliant on these externals. I think affinity groups can be helpful in driving the effort, but I don't think they should be giving any sort of like overall authority on how plans and projects roll out. I've seen that happen, where even in my case, you know, I was developing a product for a company and I was using particular language and they ran it by one of their affinity groups that had four members in it. And those four people were able to trump over my project. And none of them are therapists. It was a psychotherapeutic or psychoeducation product. And it was from, quote, my community, one of my communities that I belong to. But those four individuals in isolation. They never talked to me. They just made the decision that they were going to change the terms that were being used. And then I said, fine, I'll finish this product for you, but I'm not going to continue on with the project.
It's really interesting. I think we are coming a long way towards integration. If I look at, say, advertising now, and certainly, say, sitcoms or television, much more representation in a much more integrated way. I'm sure we have a way to go, but I'd like to think we're making some progress. Let's just move to some personal reflections now. So were there any particular setbacks along your journey? I mean, it certainly has been a very varied one that you can share.
In my early life, of course, I'd say the physical setbacks and the cognitive setbacks because of the brain illness and the paralysis. But thankfully, I got a lot of great physical therapy and speech therapy and occupational therapy, and I was able to rehab enough to the point that I was able to enlist in the military, and I'm still quite physically mobile. So I'm not having any issues now, even this late in my life. There's one experience I remember having. This is before I started my gender transition. So I was still a very masculine appearing woman. And I had become familiar with an organization doing really great work out in the community, not LGBT specific. It was broader than that. And I was invited to interview for a job. And they told me, we love you. You're so qualified. Like, I was overqualified for that position. But the position was a field position where I was going to be going out into high schools all across the United States. And they told me, we're concerned. We're concerned how parents and students, I guess, too, would receive you as a person coming into their high school being so masculine, right? Just obviously a dyke at that point. And my first reaction, you know, I kind of said to the person that was interviewing me, I said, you know, I think this is illegal. And the fact that you're telling me it means that you're willing to put that on the line, right? Because discriminating against me for that particular reason. But I so valued not only the person, but the company and the work that they were doing, that I just decided to look past that. And I interviewed for another position, a much higher position, a much higher salary, an office job with them. And I was hired and I took that job and I loved it. And I love the organization. They're still doing great work. And I love the people that are involved in the work they're doing. I begrudge them nothing. I understand why they made that decision. I didn't like it. At the time, I found it hurtful, but at the same time, I understood it. And I just realized that I was more interested in being part of their work than in sticking to a particular position, right?
No, yeah. I think we've all probably had similar experiences, probably less explicit maybe than what you experienced. But yeah, it is just about moving on and putting it behind you sometimes. Looking at any key people who influenced you in your career or life, is there anyone you can tell us about there?
Yeah, I'll mention two people. So my father has always been just a shining light in my life. He raised me as a single parent, provided me with so many opportunities to stretch and grow into my own person. My father has dementia now, so our relationship is different. I'm his durable power of attorney and his only family caregiver. I see him every week. He's in a nursing home now for veterans in Florida. And he really was just a shining light, a true beacon for me in my life. So I'm forever grateful to my father. Another person I'll mention is my mentor. So I have a mentor within the trans community, because when I was embarking on my gender transition, and this is something I would share with people early in transition also, or maybe anywhere in their transition, if you don't have a mentor, get one. I met Dr. Jameson Green. He's the author of a book called Becoming a Visible Man. He's probably at this point in his, I believe he's in his 70s now. He's older than I am by about 15, 20 years. But at the time that I met him, he was already over a decade into his transition. And I thought, you know what? I think it would be helpful for me to have a mentor. And so, and especially somebody like him, because he has been instrumental in securing trans legal rights and access to medically necessary healthcare for trans people over the last 30 years. So I approached him. I asked him if he'd be my mentor. He graciously accepted. So for the past 16 years now, he's very freely, very willingly shared his wisdom with me, his expertise. It has benefited me tremendously in my own navigation of my own journey that I call Dyke to Dude. It's actually the name of my forthcoming memoir, From Dyke to Dude, because he made that same transition journey. And so I think it really helps actually to have a mentor who has a similar experience to you. He started his gender transition when he was 39. I was 39. So I'd say, yeah, my father and Dr. Jameson Green, or James as I call him.
Well, that's a catchy title. I'll certainly be looking out for that. And any piece of advice that you received or any creed or motto that you live by?
I'll mention one that my father said pretty often as I was growing up. Because at the time I was struggling, right? I had the brain damage that left me with some personality issues. I was quite aggressive and I was having trouble in life. And we were living in a neighborhood that was Irish and Polish. So I really stuck out as like the Mexican kid in the neighborhood. And my father sat me down on a number of occasions and over most of my adolescence in particular, he would say, don't use your disability, your ethnicity, or your sex as a crutch. Use it as a ladder to get you where you need to go, right? So he said, if you're being rejected, if you're being denied entry into something, right? If people are slamming doors in your face, either figuratively, metaphorically, or realistically, right? Just keep walking and keep knocking on doors, right? He said, don't waste your time or your energy banging on doors, kicking down doors, and demanding to be let in. And those are words that I've lived by my entire life. I don't have time to deal with the revolutionaries on the left or the reactionaries on the right, right? We've got this polarization going on in our society. I live in between the revolutionaries and the reactionaries. So I'm not going to spend any of my efforts fretting about with them either, right? I just go where I'm wanted, where my expertise and my knowledge is helpful, where I can be of service to people. And that's where I put myself.
Well, that could be a subtitle to your book, I think, from dyke to dude, between the reactionaries and the revolutionaries. I think it would even be more catchy. And my very last question is, any advice you might have for your younger self?
Sure. So before I had my brain illness, I've been told I was a really quiet and passive kid. And then I became a really rambunctious kid, right, as a result of that illness. I was a really tough kid. And I didn't let people get away with bullying me. As you might imagine, people did try to bully me. Because of my paralysis, I limped. Because of my paralysis in my face, I talked a little strangely for a while until the physical therapy really started to work, right? And so I started to speak up, and I spoke up really often, very loudly. It got me into a lot of trouble with my school teachers. I spent a lot of time in the principal's office. So I don't feel like I was victimized in any particular way that I didn't call attention to. But if I were really able to sit down with my younger self, the one thing that I would tell myself is don't do drugs. I'm under the belief that if I hadn't started doing drugs, I don't do drugs now, but when I was younger, I did drugs. If I hadn't started doing drugs, I probably wouldn't have exposed myself to the particular crowd that I was hanging out with that made me vulnerable to a lot of unfortunate circumstances that I won't go into detail about. But let's just say that a young girl shouldn't be intoxicated around a lot of strange men and women. I'll just leave it at that, you can imagine. So I would say to myself, don't do drugs, not recreationally, nothing. Don't drink, don't smoke cigarettes, none of that. I really wish I could go back in time and tell myself that and start over again in that one area.
Well, durable advice for the ages there, Xander. Thank you for that. And thank you so much for sharing in a very personal and vulnerable way your extraordinary story. I think that it will be so valuable to anyone going through a similar transition. I think it's been packed with wisdom, and I can't thank you enough for coming here and being part of our Pride series.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for being interested in me and my life.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to our 50 Faces Focus series. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring professionals and their stories, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest. 'Cause I was made to be free.